I am David too. And I get to share a little bit about the privilege I've had this year just in walking into the blessings of God. I've felt this on a number of occasions. One was in September when I was grateful to participate in the Lusan Congress in Seoul, Korea. If you don't know what Lusan is, it was started in the 70s by Billy Graham and John Stott as a platform for evangelical mission. Now, the gift of Lusan is its ability to bring people together, evangelicals together, Christians together, for the sake of global mission. There were over 5,000 people present from over 200 countries, and you can imagine that so many Christians from so many cultures, there would be significant differences. While the Seoul Congress could have created a platform for debate, they largely missed the opportunity. Now, I've been to Lusan events in the past, in 2010 in Cape Town, in 2004 in Thailand, and I've learned that in going to these events that you expect a fight, and this year was no exception. And I actually would just say this to you all is your voices are important, and to find your place or to make room to come to those tables and to express what God is doing through you and in you for the sake of the global church. Now, Lusan began with the major impetus of bringing the gospel to the ends of the earth, the whole gospel, the whole church, to the whole world. It emphasized proclamation and reaching unreached people groups. Others said, yes, but the gospel is holistic. Some thought that the Seoul Congress did not emphasize enough the proclamation of the gospel, while others thought that the Congress was dismissive of holistic mission. Some think that the priority of mission is reaching the least reach, while others focus on our response to human need and witness to justice. Where would you land? For most of the last 30 years, I have served with an organization called Word Made Flesh. I've worked primarily in Romania with vulnerable families, abandoned children, kids living on the streets. This past summer, when I was on my way back home on a bus from the Bucharest airport to my home city, the bus stopped for a rest break, and I saw somebody from the back of her head, and I thought I recognized her. And before I startled her, I made sure I saw her face before I gave her a hug. And it was Julia, who I've changed her name for the sake of protecting her identity. But I hadn't seen her for 7 years. I've known her since she was 3. She grew up at our community center as part of our lives. She was on her way back to Galați, Romania for the baptism of her baby niece and to be with her own daughter. Now, I met Julia through kids that were living on the streets. They were living in the same dilapidated house that Julia and her little brother and her dad were living in. You can imagine the house was so bad that kids preferred to live on the streets rather than stay in the home. Her brother, I'll call Sorin, he was a year younger, really a poster child for attachment disorder. They grew up with their father, but he passed away when Julia was just 7. They lived with their mother for a year before she left them with relatives to work abroad and never came back. When we learned about the abuse that Julia and Sorin were suffering in their home, we involved the authorities for child protection who put them in their center for minors. But there they were abused again. So we found a foster family who took them in. After a few years, they came to live with our staff. They survived a very challenging life of poverty, abuse, and rejection. From our first encounters, they heard about God's love and hopefully experienced it. Growing up at our center, they learned about the Bible and went to church. Would we consider them reached with the gospel? I love these kids, and it has been a privilege to watch them grow up, but this is a non-heroic missionary story. For the past years, Julia has been doing sex work in Western Europe to provide for her daughter. Now, you should know that in the neighborhood where we work, almost every single girl considers sex work a career option. Sorin, he pimped out his girlfriend and ended up doing some jail time. These stories don't make for a good prayer letter to your supporters. But just as I've been able to grieve and their bad decisions, to witness their pains, I've also been able to celebrate their achievements. Sorin, a few years ago, stopped his illicit activities, officially married his girlfriend, They had a daughter who he adores and who he recently baptized in the church. At this baptism dinner, this is the day after I arrived back in Romania, walking into the privileges of God's grace and mercy. I was around 10 other kids that grew up at our center and seeing how God has grown them up, raised them. I sat at the table with Sorin and Julia's mother, who had abandoned them, but they had invited to come to this baptism party. At the dinner, Julia told me that she's not returning to Western Europe, but wants to stay home and care for her daughter, which she has done. Now, I can't say that any of this was the fruit of our missional work, but rather in mission, we get a front row seat to see the deep work of God who refuses to let us go. A few days after the baptism, Julie met me at our center and we reminisced about her time growing up there. She confessed, amongst other things, that she was struggling to forgive her mom. And she said she'd just recently mentioned that to her brother. And her brother replied, "Well, without our mom, maybe we wouldn't be the people we are today." Witnessing the work of the Spirit in their lives, doing what we cannot do, but we're privileged to witness. This is why I believe that there is no mission except holistic mission. Julia and Serene and the families we work with in Romania are reached only through long-term commitment and relationship and support. Although it's difficult to answer the call to enter into the pains of the world, especially the suffering of children, we're privileged to witness the work of the Spirit, bringing them to the church, bringing them to marriage, bringing them to baptism, working in ways that calls them to forgive those who have deeply wounded them, and seeing God's redemption of all things. Come, Lord Jesus.
Morning. It's an honor to be here. So a story that I want to share will hopefully testify to the character of God, much like what we've already heard so much today, that the character of God is to come to his people when we're needy, when we're hungry for him. And I know I'm becoming more convinced that it's God's desire simply to fulfill us, to meet our needs when that is where we find ourselves. And I want to read Isaiah 57:15. "For thus says the one who is high and lifted up, who inhabits eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place, and also with him who is of a contrite and lowly spirit, to revive the spirit of the lowly and to revive the heart of the contrite." And it's my testimony that the Lord's character is good, and merciful and compassionate, and it's really his compassion that I kind of wanted to focus on, and it's something that's become very important to me and has become the fulfillment of a lot of prayers that I've been praying. And my story really begins in late October 2022, actually. I had visited some friends in a different state, kind of gotten out of the normal routine of my life, and I was just having a really good time, to be honest with you. And I knew that the Lord was near, and I was able to love these people and just do life with them and have kind of a sense of normalcy where my day-to-day was just getting to be such a grind. I'm sure you can relate to that. But then I came home, and that grind honestly just became really depressing. And so I was looking back, and I'd like to share part of a journal entry that I wrote at that time. Forgive me in advance if I get emotional reading this. "God, why can't I just be happy and not have to deal with all of my mess? Why do I have to be here? Why do I have to experience these deserts where nothing satisfies me? Why am I so depressed? Why am I so down? Why, God, why do I feel so unfree? Why am I so out of touch with you, the real you? Where is my faith? God, answer me. God, have mercy on me. Why? God, why?" And even that probably can't adequately explain the pain or the agony that I was in, but maybe some of you can relate to a sense of just purposelessness and aimlessness and just a lack of connection with the Lord. But in my brokenness, he came to me, and it was a journey, but he has himself shown me how he wants to be my satisfaction. That was late October 2022. In February 2023, I had the privilege of visiting Wilmore to visit the outpouring. At that time, I had no idea that I would be coming back to school here. To be honest with you, going to seminary wasn't even an option in my mind. But that's neither here nor there. I was studying, sitting outside of the seminary library, looking on the lawn where all the people were. There was lines that I didn't want to be in for hours, and people were worshiping the Lord on the lawn, and there was projections and a bunch of stuff going on, and I just sat down and I was studying Matthew 9, verses 35 through 38. I had decided to study the Lord's compassion through the book of Matthew, and I was in that passage, and verses 36 through 37 kind of really just gripped me, and I'll read those verses. When he, that is Jesus, saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few." I'm sure you know how it goes from there. And I can't really explain it, but this revelation that I had of Jesus' compassion for the people, and there was something about looking out at all the people that were on the lawn that just something really clicked with me, and I just felt, I don't even know, the Lord's compassion, the Lord's heart for other people. And though I was continuing to wrestle with my own inadequacies, I was beginning to feel more and more assured of his love, and more especially of his plan. That sense of purpose was kind of coming in, and I was losing that sense of just a disconnect with the Lord, but I was becoming more assured of his love for me and his love for others, and I just knew that he was fulfilling that cry, that prayer that he had birthed in me back in October. And so the same summer, 2023, I visited Honduras, and I took that prayer with me. I was on a short-term missions trip. I was very blessed. It was a very diverse missions trip in the sense that it was never the same thing every day, and I had no idea what was going to happen. But in the mornings, I would pray. We were in the capital city, which is Tegucigalpa, and I was looking over. The city is kind of in a bowl, and we're on the outskirts, like on the side of a hill. So I'm looking over the downtown in the mornings, just praying, and all the lights are on in the city, and I'm just asking the Lord, you know, like, what do I do? What would you have me do? And I was praying that prayer along with just crying out for more revelation of his heart for people. And before I left Honduras, one word dropped into my heart, my mind. I don't know how to explain that, but you probably understand. And like I had said, I had no thought of going to seminary, but that was the word that he dropped in my heart, seminary, before I left Honduras. And I came home and talked to my pastor about it, and he was pretty much like, yeah, do that. And after doing a little bit of research, he was the one who suggested I check out Asbury, and I did, and I made arrangements to move to Wilmore from Northern Kentucky. I was working in a full-time parachurch ministry, and before I knew it, here I was, and the Lord has been continuing to answer my prayers for a revelation of his heart, and just greater purpose, not just to know him, but to make him known, and he's been teaching me a few things, especially lately. In my time here, the first one is just like bringing me to a grinding halt, like stop, slow down, teaching me. He's been teaching me how to pour out my heart before him. The Psalm 62:8, where the psalmist instructs the people of the Lord to trust in him and to pour out our hearts before him, has been really important to me as I've learned to just be honest with the Lord and where I'm at. I've also been learning to focus on the Lord, and my fellowship group has been hugely impactful. We meet every Friday night, the Robinsons, the Christians, Grace, Josiah, of course, my fiance Ruth, just all been encouraging me to keep my eyes on the Lord, and it's been hugely important. I've also been learning a lot about the history of the Lord's dealings with his people, and gaining understanding and tools to get his word in me and to make his word known through the classes here. And so overall, I'm just testifying that I have been growing in my desire to know him more and to help others to know him also. And just knowing for myself and also knowing that when we seek him, whatever distractions, discouragements, or downcast faces might take us away from his call on our lives, I just know that at the foot of his cross, even though it's foolish to so many, that's the place where we can again see his face and become recentered in his will for our lives.
I am sorry that my name isn't David. I was praying about what to share with you guys today, and I thought that I would start with IBS of Matthew. Not the whole class, but I would start with some of my experience that I've had in it. See, every Tuesday and Thursday at 9:30 in the morning, I meet with Jesus. I walk into Curry McFeeters, room 202, and there he is waiting for me. On my most stubborn days, I make eye contact. It's like a staring contest for us. But a lot of days, I can't really seem to hold his gaze. And as cool as it would be to have Jesus like physically waiting for me there with Dr. Bauer, I'm talking about this portrait of him that hangs in there. A lot of you guys probably know what I'm talking about. And no matter where I move around in the classroom, because I have moved seats, I look there. And there he is, staring at me. And I don't know why, but it just makes me squirm a little bit sometimes. Like, no matter how I shift or I squirm, I tend to find myself looking up and over, and I just see him, looking at those eyes that are seemingly boring into mine. And the topic of conversation came up in one of my other classes, and Dr. Stone mentioned that we have pictures of Jesus in every room in this building. And I can understand why we chose this one. It's beautiful. I don't really know if it's like exactly what Jesus looked like, but what I do know is that the expression on his face is beautiful. It's inviting. It's kind. The disposition of it is just so hospitable. And I do imagine that when people looked at Jesus, they saw that face a lot. If he was around their dinner table or if he was teaching them, his disciples probably knew that face well. So I wrestled with why a picture of Jesus that beholds such gentleness, that maybe even depicts the very essence of who he was, made me squirm the way that it does. One day, gently in my spirit, as I was looking at this picture, the Lord made me realize that for whatever reason, when I look at this picture, I'm reminded of the depiction of Jesus in Revelation, where we are told that he has eyes like flames of fire. The passage says, "The hair of his head was white as wool, white as snow, and his eyes were like fiery flame." Nowhere in the portrait are Jesus' eyes actually on fire, but maybe it's the way that they just kind of peer into me with this intensity that feels like a flame that makes me think of this Jesus with fiery eyes. And Charles Spurgeon says, "Why are Jesus' eyes like flames of fire? Why first to discern the secrets of all hearts? There are no secrets here that Christ does not see. There's nothing that Christ does not read. His eyes are like flames of fire to read us through and through and through." So no wonder it makes me squirm. His eyes are like flames of fire that read us through and through and through, and I do. I feel read through and through and through. It's no secret to a lot of you guys, to most of you in here, that this has been a pretty challenging semester for me. I came back to campus after a summer that burnt me out, and I was looking forward to being back in my Wilmore, at my Asbury, to my normal and my security. And I wasn't prepared for this, but this year wasn't what normal was for me, which makes sense because everything had changed. I found myself in a new place, living with new people. I was in a new job, I was in a new degree program, and I'll be honest, I do not handle transition well. Community looked different for me, my classes were harder, I spent so much time in the library this semester, and I found myself going home a lot of days feeling pretty lonely and overwhelmed and frustrated that my Wilmore and my Asbury didn't look like I thought it would this year. And then I'd come into this class and Jesus would be staring at me with his eyes of fire and I'd just feel so frustrated. And then I'd feel like the shame or guilt that I was frustrated because life wasn't living up to the expectations that I had put on it, and I did have a hard time admitting that to myself and to my God. Things just really did not feel like they were going my way. And then To round that out, on September 16th, I was actually expressing these feelings in a meeting to my fellow chaplains when I looked down and I had several missed phone calls from my parents. So I stepped out of the meeting and I called my mom back and I received the news that my childhood home that I'd lived in since I was 2 weeks old had burned to the ground. Our house had been struck by lightning in the middle of a monsoon, and honestly, praise be to God, my father smelt the smoke right away, so he got my mom and the dogs and they got out, but they had to sit and watch as it burned. The fire station in my town is located less than a half mile from my house, but the roads were flooded so they couldn't get to the home. And then to top it all off, it stopped raining after the house caught fire and only started raining again when the house was completely gone. So yeah, the kind of grief that I felt in the days and weeks following was one that I didn't really know where to place. A lot of my prayers in my room or car or chapels around campus were simply silent cries of my heart as I wept. All I could do was echo day after day Eli. When Samuel brought him devastating news, he said, "He is the Lord, so let him do what he thinks is good." It was one morning while I was sitting in IBS of Matthew, staring at Jesus with his eyes of fire, that I felt him ask me, "Mackenzie, am I enough for you?" See, my freshman year of college, a speaker came to our chapel and asked us that very same question, and it's a question that I've wrestled with for years. I've always wanted to say yes, but I think in honesty, there's always been something that's taken my unbridled commitment, if it's a job or a grade or a community, something that's taken the space of my heart and made me realize that my attention is divided. Dr. Geyertsen told us in chapel earlier this semester that a friend once told him, "Jesus will never be enough for you until Jesus is all that you have." And so that became my prayer day in and day out. "Jesus, will you make yourself enough for me?" Still, though, that morning, it really did kind of feel like salt just being rubbed in a wound. And I sat there looking at Jesus with his eyes like fire. And then suddenly the image that he'd been giving me all semester just became all too ironic. Because Jesus with his holy fire is meant to be my deepest desire. But all I know of fire is that it's destructive. And that it's not safe. And it's all-consuming. And it's harsh. And it's unpredictable. And it burns you. And when it does, it sears. And I wrestled with that tension for quite some time, and it was only through surrendering it at the Lord's feet that I felt him say, "Child, do you forget that I'm the one who flips everything on its head?" I came into the realization that holy fire is not like the fire that I know. It is purifying, yes, but it's also warm. And his fire is uncontrollable and uncontainable, but it's also inviting and comforting. When I think of the Jesus I know and love, why would this purifying fire be one that I'm scared of? Perhaps it is destructive and all-consuming and uncontainable and wild, but I'm purified by the one within me who's named my advocate. Therefore, if it destroys the very version of myself that can't say that Jesus and Jesus alone is enough for me, I can trust that that's good. Sometimes I think I'm nervous that if I really look back at those eyes of fire, those flames will lick over me and burn me, and they'll call me unfaithful or disobedient or point out my every flaw. But when I do allow myself to look at those eyes of Jesus, I realize that his fire doesn't burn me, it offers my soul warmth. They say to me, "Yes, I do read you through and through and through, and still I offer warmth in even the coldest of places. And still I offer you kindness, and still I offer you comfort." And those flames don't cover me, whispering to me my every fault, they refine me. And it's through that refinement that I received the revelation of just how truly I have everything I need in Jesus. There's so many times I asked Jesus this semester in desperation, "Where have you been?" And when I really invited him to open the eyes of my heart to that, I was overwhelmed by all the ways he told me that I wasn't abandoned, all the ways that I could see him around me. I see him in the ginkgo leaves, and I see him in the frost on the ground. I see him in my Hebrew reading group. Shout out Hayden, thank you so much for the semester. I see him in my roommates, my new roommates, and the ones from last year. I see him in my boyfriend and my best friend, Emily. I see him in chapel all the time, especially when I have the privilege to serve. I see him through the student leaders I have the privilege of working with, the RAs and my fellow chaplains. I see him in my band, Nora and Daisha. I see him in our bosses. I see him through all of my friends here. I really wish I could name all of you. I wish I had the time to. I see so many of you in here today, and I see him so uniquely in each of you. I see him in the students who surrounded me in prayer as I wept the evening after the fire. I see him in all three of my professors. I see him in serving as student chaplain because I'm blessed so deeply to walk with so many of you in this room. When you invite me to celebrate, when you celebrate, I see him. And when you invite me to grieve, when you grieve, I see him. I see him through my parents, whose community has surrounded and loved them in astounding ways. And I see him incredibly through the testimony that they've been able to share through this. They've told me countless stories of seeds being planted in people, and their testimony has been used as a vessel to turn hearts back to the Father. And so if I lose every earthly possession, but there's one more soul who reaches eternity because of it, there's really nothing I can do but celebrate that. And I will say, he is the Lord, let him do what he thinks is good. And I wrestle with the theology of what's ordained versus simply allowed, but what I do know is that whatever he thinks is good, I will trust that it's sovereign. And I will trust that what he thinks is good is nothing but perfect and loving and holy. And I could go on, but I am so convinced I'm over my time limit. So what I will leave you with today is I really could spend my whole life worshiping him for all the things I just listed, and it still wouldn't be all the gratitude he deserves. When I look at all the ways that I see Jesus around me, like when I really look for not just his hand, but his face, when I really look for who he is as my provider, not just the provision he gives, that is when, if I am asked, is Jesus enough for you, I can confidently say yes, abundantly more than I could ever ask, think, or imagine.